A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one about the long-term renter's dilemma. He's saying that as renting becomes more the norm, more people are going to negotiate contracts that let them actually live in their space, including hanging things on walls. But every tenancy ends eventually. So he's asking two things. First, what hanging solutions and wall anchors make the whole put-in take-out process less of a nightmare? And second, when you do leave, how do you fill those holes, fix cosmetic scratches, and match paint colors so you get your deposit back? This is basically the renter's version of, how do I exist in my own home without financial penalty?
It's a question that the rental market itself has been slow to answer. There was a Wirecutter piece that really nailed this. They pointed out that most landlords still treat walls like museum surfaces, but tenants are expected to live full lives in front of them for years at a time. The tension there is real. You want to hang shelving, art, a mirror that doesn't fall on your toddler, but you also want to avoid a $1,000 repainting fee on move-out.
The $1,000 fee for a service the landlord was probably going to do between tenants anyway. That's the part that stings.
And in some jurisdictions, there's actually case law forming around this. The idea of reasonable wear and tear is being tested more aggressively. I saw a case out of Massachusetts where a tenant successfully argued that a full repaint deduction was unreasonable because the walls had already been painted 5 years before move-in and were due for refresh regardless of the nail holes. The court basically said, you can't charge the tenant for depreciation that was already baked into the asset.
That feels like a landmark ruling that nobody heard about because it's about drywall.
Tenant law is full of those, quiet victories that never make headlines. But let's start with the practical side, because the tools exist. The question is which ones actually work and which ones are basically just marketing.
Let's do anchors first. We've talked about monkey hooks before. Those are the ones that go into drywall with a tiny pinhole and hold up to, what, 50 pounds?
About 50 pounds for the large ones, yes. The standard size holds around 35. And the hole they leave is genuinely tiny, maybe an eighth of an inch. The mechanism is clever. It's a curved wire that levers against the back of the drywall. No expansion, no plastic sleeve, no toggle. You just push it in at an angle and it locks. The physics are elegant. The load transfers to the back face of the drywall across a broad curve, so you're not concentrating force at a single point the way a nail would. You pull it straight out, leaves that tiny hole. For filling, which we'll get to, it's about as minimal as you can get with a mechanical anchor. The limitation is that they only work for items where the mounting bracket sits flush and the load is mostly shear, meaning downward force, not pulling outward. So a heavy mirror with a wire on the back, great. A shelf that cantilevers out from the wall, not great.
Because the cantilever pulls the top of the anchor forward.
Think of it like a lever. The shelf is the long arm, the wall is the fulcrum, and the top anchor is being pulled straight out of the drywall. Monkey hooks have almost no resistance to outward pull. That's where you'd want something with more grip. And this is where the conversation gets into what's actually renter-friendly versus what's technically removable. But you'll regret it.
Like those plastic expansion anchors that come free with every shelf bracket ever sold.
The ribbed plastic ones. Those are the worst offenders. They're designed to be permanent. You drill a hole, hammer them in, and when you try to remove them later, they either snap off inside the wall or tear out a chunk of drywall on the way out. The Wirecutter review actually called them out specifically. They said, if you're renting, throw away the included anchors and buy something better. I'd go further. Throw them away even if you own the place. They're just bad hardware.
The glockenspiel of landlord resentment.
I don't know what that means.
It's the thing that seems harmless and cheerful until you realize it's the source of all your problems. A glockenspiel seems like a cute little instrument, and then a child gets one and you understand true suffering.
I'll take your word for it. So, the alternatives. For medium loads, say 10 to 25 pounds, I point people toward threaded drywall anchors. These are the ones that look like large plastic screws. You screw them directly into the drywall, no pre-drilling needed with most of them, and they have deep threads that bite into the gypsum. The key advantage for renters is that they're fully reversible. You unscrew them the same way you put them in, and they leave a clean hole about half an inch across.
Half an inch is still a hole you have to fill.
It is, but it's a consistent, round hole, not a ragged crater. And filling a clean half-inch hole takes about 30 seconds with the right compound, which we'll cover. The bigger issue with threaded anchors is that people over-tighten them and strip the drywall. That's when the hole becomes a problem. You want them snug, not torqued down like a lug nut. The gypsum core has essentially no ability to recover once it's been compressed past its limit. You strip it, and suddenly that clean half-inch hole is a crumbly mess.
I've seen people do that. They treat drywall like it's structural steel.
Drywall is essentially compressed gypsum powder between two sheets of paper. It has almost no tensile strength. Any anchor that relies on gripping the gypsum itself is gambling on the integrity of something that crumbles if you look at it wrong. Which is why, if you do use threaded anchors, you stop turning the moment you feel resistance ramp up sharply. That's the anchor seating. Anything past that is you destroying the wall.
Which brings us to toggle bolts, presumably.
Toggle bolts and their modern cousins, the strap toggles, sometimes called snap toggles or togglers, which is a brand name that became generic. These are the heavy-duty option. You drill a hole, push the toggle through, and it springs open behind the drywall. Then, you tighten the bolt, and the toggle spreads the load across a much larger area on the back side of the wall. They can hold upwards of 100 pounds and half-inch drywall. The load distribution is the whole game. Instead of point loading a quarter-inch circle of gypsum, you're spreading it across a metal bar that might be 2 or 3 inches long.
The renter-friendly version.
The strap toggle is the one. The metal channel stays in place behind the drywall even if you remove the bolt, which means if you ever want to rehang something in the same spot, you can. But for move-out, you remove the bolt, push the strap through the hole, and patch. The hole is usually 3/8 to half an inch, again, clean and round. The downside is you need a drill and a half-inch bit, and installation is slightly more involved than a monkey hook. But for a heavy mirror, a wall-mounted TV, a large piece of art in a substantial frame, this is the right tool.
None of these require finding a stud.
None of them require a stud. That's the whole point of drywall anchors. But I should say, if you can find a stud, use the stud. A screw into a stud holds more weight than any anchor ever will, and removal leaves a hole that's even easier to fill. The problem for renters is that studs are never where you want them to be.
The studs are always exactly 6 inches to the left of where the perfect centering would be.
It's like a law of physics, so anchors it is. And I'd rank them for renter friendliness. Monkey hooks for light to medium loads where you want the absolute smallest hole. Threaded anchors for medium loads where you don't mind a slightly larger but clean hole, and strap toggles for anything heavy. Avoid expansion anchors. Avoid molly bolts unless you know what you're doing. Molly bolts are permanent and a nightmare to remove cleanly. They're designed to crush down behind the drywall and never come out. Trying to extract one is like trying to unpop a popcorn kernel.
What about the adhesive route, command strips, and their competitors?
This is where the conversation gets interesting, because the adhesive market has evolved a lot. Command strips, made by 3M, use a stretch-release adhesive. The idea is you pull the tab straight down, the adhesive stretches and loses its grip, and the strip comes off clean.
Those are doing a lot of work in that sentence.
The wire cutter testing found that command strips work reliably when 3 conditions are met. 1. The surface is completely clean and smooth, no texture, no dust, no residue. 2. The weight is well within the rated limit, and the rated limits are for ideal conditions, so you want margin. 3. And this is the one people mess up most often, you follow the removal instructions exactly. Pull straight down, slowly, parallel to the wall. Don't pull outward, don't yank.
People pull outward and then act surprised when the paint comes with it.
The strip relies on the stretching action to debond. If you pull at an angle, you're transferring force into the paint layer instead of the adhesive interface. And paint, especially cheap landlord paint, will separate from the drywall paper before the adhesive gives up, so you end up with a strip of paint peeled clean off. The failure mode is catastrophic. It's not a small touch-up. It's a strip of missing paint that's 4 inches long and an inch wide.
Like adopting a feral cat. Works great until it doesn't, and then you have a real problem.
The other issue is time. Command strips are rated for removal within a certain window. They don't say this explicitly on the package, but the adhesive can cure harder over years, especially in high humidity environments. I've seen strips that were up for 5 years come off fine, and I've seen strips that were up for 18 months take the paint with them. There's an element of luck, and the humidity variable is real. A bathroom strip and a bedroom strip are living in completely different environments, but the package rating doesn't distinguish.
Adhesives are for the risk-tolerant or the very careful.
Or for situations where mechanical anchors aren't practical. A lightweight poster frame on a textured wall where you can't get a clean hole. Command strip might be your only option. But for anything you care about, I'd rather patch a small hole than peel a 6-inch strip of paint. Holes are predictable. Paint peeling is not. A hole is a known quantity. You know exactly what you're dealing with. A paint peel is a mystery. How deep does it go? Did it take the paper with it? Is the landlord going to notice?
Let's move to the second part then. The move-out ritual. You've taken down your anchors, you're staring at a constellation of holes, and maybe some scuffs from where the furniture rubbed. What do you actually do?
The gold standard for filling holes is a lightweight spackling compound. Not caulk, not toothpaste, and yes, people use toothpaste, it's a terrible idea because it shrinks and attracts insects, and not the heavy-duty joint compound that pros use for taping drywall seams. Lightweight spackle is designed exactly for this. It's pre-mixed, it goes on pink and dries white, which is useful because you can see when it's ready to sand. The color change technology came out of the auto body industry, actually. They've been using indicator compounds in Bondo for years before it migrated to home repair.
The color change thing is not a gimmick.
It's not a gimmick. It's a practical indicator. Spackle shrinks as it dries, so you want to overfill the hole slightly and then sand it flush. If you sand too early, you'll smear wet compound and make a mess. The color change tells you when it's fully cured. For small nail holes, you might not even need to sand. A damp cloth can smooth the surface while it's still workable. You just swipe across the hole with a slightly damp rag and it levels the compound without generating dust.
For larger holes from threaded anchors or toggle bolts?
Same compound, but you might need two applications. Fill the hole, let it dry, and if it's shrunk below the surface, apply a second thin coat. Then sand with a fine grit sanding sponge, something around 220 grit. The sponge is important because it conforms to the wall's slight irregularities. A rigid sanding block can create flat spots that catch the light differently. You'll end up with a shiny patch that's technically smooth, but visibly wrong because it doesn't match the surrounding texture.
Then the paint.
This is where most renters lose the battle. Matching paint is hard. Even if you have the original paint can, which almost no renter does, paint on the wall has aged. It's faded from UV exposure, it's picked up microscopic dirt, it's been cleaned with whatever cleaning products. A fresh dab of the exact same paint will often look visibly different. I've seen people pull the original can out of storage, apply it carefully, and end up with a patch that looks like a fresh bruise on old skin.
I kept the touch-up jar. Strategy is insufficient.
It's better than nothing, but it's not foolproof. The family handyman has a good guide on this. They recommend taking a chip of the existing paint to a paint store for color matching. Most hardware stores now have spectrophotometers that can analyze a sample and mix a match. The technology is actually impressive. But it's still matching to the aged color, not the original. The machine doesn't know what the paint looked like in 2019. It only knows what it looks like now.
Which means you're matching the wall as it is now, not as it was when painted.
And that's what you want. The tip that a lot of people miss is to take the chip from an inconspicuous area, behind a switch plate, inside a closet, and make it at least an inch square. The machine needs a certain amount of surface area to get an accurate reading. If you bring in a flake the size of a fingernail clipping, the sensor can't get a reliable average. You need enough real estate for the spectrophotometer to do its job.
What about sheen? That's the thing I always hear people get wrong.
Sheen is the silent killer. You can match the color perfectly and still have the patch stand out because the sheen is wrong. Most rental walls are painted in eggshell or flat. Flat hides imperfections best, which is why landlords love it, but it's also the hardest to clean. Eggshell has a slight sheen. If you touch up a flat wall with eggshell paint, the patch will shine under light and be visible from across the room. It'll look like someone waxed a single spot on the wall.
The landlord will notice.
The landlord will absolutely notice, because they're looking for it. They walk into an empty apartment and their eye goes straight to any irregularity on the walls. It's practically a professional skill, so you need to know the sheen. If you don't know, flat is the safer bet for touch-ups. A flat patch on an eggshell wall is less noticeable than the reverse. But the real pro move is to test a tiny dot in an inconspicuous corner and let it dry completely before committing.
This old house had a piece on this, didn't they?
They recommend what they call feathering, applying the touch-up paint with a small foam roller and rolling outward from the center of the patch so the edges thin out. A brush leaves distinct edges, a foam roller blends the new paint into the old, and they emphasize using as little paint as possible. Multiple thin coats, not one thick blob. The roller also imparts a slight texture that mimics the original application. Most rental walls were rolled, not brushed, so a brush touch-up stands out immediately because the texture is wrong.
The blob is the amateur's signature.
The blob is how you announce to the world that you didn't know what you were doing. It creates a raised spot that's visible even if the color is perfect, because the texture is wrong and it catches light differently. Light hits that raised edge and creates a tiny shadow. The human eye is incredibly good at detecting that kind of discontinuity. We evolved to spot the lion in the grass. We're now using that same visual processing to spot bad spackle jobs.
What about scratches and scuffs that aren't holes? The kind of thing where the paint is damaged but the drywall underneath is fine.
For shallow scratches, you can often skip the spackle entirely. A light sanding with very fine grit, we're talking 400 or higher, can smooth the edges of the scratch. Then clean the area, prime if the scratch has exposed bare drywall paper, and paint. If you paint directly over exposed drywall paper without priming, the paper absorbs moisture from the paint differently, and you get what's called flashing, a visible difference in texture and sheen.
That's the word for it.
That's the technical term. And it's one of those things that, once you see it, you can't unsee it. A small can of primer is worth having. The spray primers are convenient for spot work, but they're easy to overapply. A small brush-on primer gives you more control. And you want a primer that's specifically labeled for drywall or for covering stains. Not all primers are created equal for this purpose.
The full move-out kit, if you're being serious about it, is spackle, a sanding sponge, primer, match paint in the right sheen, a small foam roller, and a putty knife.
A damp cloth. And ideally, a chip of your wall paint that you took before you moved in, stored in a labeled bag. That's the pro move. Take photos of every wall when you move in, and take a paint chip from behind a switch plate. Store them together. When you move out 3 years later, you're not scrambling. You're not making 3 trips to the hardware store trying to get the match right. You walk in with your envelope of chips and you're done in an afternoon.
That's the kind of advice that sounds obsessive, until you're staring at a $3,000 deposit deduction.
The deposit deductions are where this gets unfair for renters in a lot of places. Many leases specify that the tenant is responsible for returning the walls to their original condition, but original condition is undefined. A wall that's been lived in front of for 3 years will not look like a freshly painted wall. The question is where reasonable wear and tear ends and damage begins. And that's a legal question as much as a practical one.
That line is different depending on which side of the lease you're on.
Some jurisdictions are starting to codify this. In California, for example, landlords are required to provide an itemized list of deductions with receipts, and they can't charge for normal wear and tear. But what counts as normal? Nail holes for hanging pictures are generally considered normal wear and tear in most tenant-friendly jurisdictions, but a wall full of toggle bolt holes might not be. The distinction often comes down to whether the modification was reasonable for normal living. Hanging a few pictures? Installing a floor-to-ceiling climbing wall?
Which is why the anchor choice matters on the way in.
It matters enormously. A monkey hook leaves a hole so small that many landlords won't even notice it, and if they do, it's clearly normal use, the equivalent of a thumbtack hole. A half-inch toggle bolt hole is harder to argue, is normal wear and tear, even if it's clean and properly patched. The patching itself can become the issue. If the touch-up is visible, the landlord might argue the wall needs repainting, and then you're paying for the whole wall, not just the patch. That's how a $5 spackle job turns into an $800 repaint.
Which circles back to the feathering technique. The goal isn't just to fill the hole. The goal is to make the repair invisible enough that the landlord doesn't have a pretext to repaint on your dime.
That's a good framing. It's not about perfection, it's about removing the pretext. Most landlords aren't inspecting walls with a magnifying glass. They're walking through the empty apartment looking for obvious issues. If they don't see anything, they move on. The repair doesn't need to be museum quality. It needs to not catch the eye. There's a concept in set design called the 10-foot rule. If it looks good from 10 feet away, it's good enough. Same principle applies here.
The chair nobody notices they're sitting in.
The repair equivalent of that.
What about larger damage? Say a shelf bracket pulled out and left a crater. Or you mounted something with those terrible expansion anchors, and they tore out a chunk of drywall.
That's a drywall patch, not a spackle job. You're into different territory. For anything larger than about half an inch, you need a patch kit. The mesh patches work for holes up to a couple of inches. You stick the self-adhesive mesh over the hole, spackle over it, sand, and paint. For larger holes, you're cutting out the damaged section and putting in a new piece of drywall, which is a bigger project but still doable for a motivated renter. There are tutorials online that walk you through the California patch method, which is clever because you leave a border of the paper facing on your patch piece and use joint compound to blend it into the surrounding wall. No backing board required.
At what point do you just accept the deposit loss and move on?
That's a real calculation. If you've got a hole the size of a fist and you've never done drywall repair, the odds of your patch looking worse than the hole are not zero. A bad patch draws more attention than the damage it's covering. In that case, you might be better off leaving it and negotiating with the landlord directly. Sometimes they'd rather handle the repair themselves and deduct the actual cost rather than discovering your failed DIY attempt and charging for a full reskim.
There's a humility in knowing when you're out of your depth.
That humility can save you money. I've seen tenants spend $50 on patch kits and paint, spend a weekend on repairs, and still lose their deposit because the work was visibly amateur. At that point, you've paid twice, once in materials and time, once in the deposit deduction. It's the sunk cost fallacy with spackle. You think, well, I've already bought the supplies, so I might as well use them. But using them badly is worse than not using them at all.
The smart renter strategy is small holes, handle yourself. Big damage. Have a conversation.
Take photos of the walls when you move in. Take photos of the walls after you've patched and touched up. If the landlord tries to claim damage that predated your tenancy, you want the evidence. This is the unglamorous side of renting. It's part home life, part evidence management. You're building a paper trail not because you're paranoid, but because the system is structured in a way that rewards documentation.
The renter as archivist of their own existence.
It's not a great system, but it's the system we have. And the people who navigate it best are the ones who treat move-out preparation as a process that starts on move-in day, not the week before the lease ends. The photos, the paint chips, the awareness of what you're hanging and how all of that is move-out prep happening in real time.
To synthesize what we've covered, anchors go monkey hook for light, threaded for medium, strap toggle for heavy, avoid the free plastic ones. Adhesives are a calculated risk. Fill holes with lightweight spackle, sand with a sponge, prime exposed paper, match paint with a chip and get the sheen right, apply with a foam roller and feather the edges. And if the damage is beyond your skill level, negotiate instead of hiding it.
That's the checklist. And I'd add one more thing. If you're a long-term renter negotiating a lease, try to get language in there about hanging items being explicitly permitted and nail holes being considered normal wear and tear. It's easier to negotiate on the way in than to argue on the way out. Most landlords use a standard lease template. They're often willing to add a clause or an addendum if you ask before signing. After signing, your leverage disappears.
The lease is prenup for walls.
That's not a bad way to think about it. You're agreeing in advance what happens when the relationship ends. And most landlords actually don't care about a few nail holes. They care about surprise damage and tenants who disappear without addressing it. A tenant who says up front, I want to hang things and I commit to repairing the walls properly when I leave, is signaling that they're responsible. That goes a long way. It changes the dynamic from adversarial to cooperative before it ever has a chance to become adversarial.
If the landlord still says no,
then you're probably dealing with someone who's going to find a reason to keep your deposit no matter what you do, and that's useful information to have before you sign the lease. A landlord who won't allow a single nail hole is telling you something about how they view the relationship.
Better to know the landlord is unreasonable before you've invested in curtains.
Curtains, shelving, a gallery wall of your kids' artwork. All the things that make a rented space feel like a home rather than a way station. And that's really what this is about. The ability to hang things on walls isn't just about decoration. It's about the psychological experience of living somewhere. If you can't put up a single photo for 3 years because you're terrified of the deposit, that's not a home. That's storage for your body.
We're seeing more people push back on that. The long-term renter who says, "No, I live here. I'm paying for this space. I should be able to make it mine within reasonable limits."
The market is slowly responding. You see it in the rise of renter-friendly products. Not just the anchors and patches, but entire product lines built around the idea that people want to customize without permanent alteration. Peel and stick wallpaper that actually comes off clean. Removable backsplash tiles. The whole renter-friendly upgrade category on home improvement sites. It's a recognition that renting isn't just a temporary stopgap anymore. For a lot of people, it's the long-term reality.
Peel and stick wallpaper that actually comes off clean. That's a phrase doing heroic amounts of work.
The technology has improved. The early versions were basically contact paper and they left residue everywhere. The newer ones use a different adhesive formulation that's removable. But like command strips, the results depend on the surface and the conditions. On a smooth, properly primed wall, they work. On textured plaster in a 100-year-old building, less so. The adhesive needs a surface it can bond to evenly. Textured walls create an inconsistent bond, so some spots stick harder than others, and removal becomes unpredictable.
The asterisk is doing a lot of heavy lifting in the renter product industry.
The asterisk is the most important character in the entire catalog. Removes cleanly. Asterisk. No damage. Asterisk. Works on most surfaces. Asterisk. The asterisk is where the reality lives. And the reality is almost always more complicated than the headline claim. That doesn't mean the products are bad. It means they're tools, and tools require understanding their limitations.
We should do a whole episode on asterisks.
I think we just did, in a way. The entire renter experience is navigating the gap between the marketing claim and the asterisk. Between live your best life in your rental and subject to the following 17 conditions. The skill isn't finding products without asterisks. It's reading the asterisks and making informed decisions.
All right, let's get Hilbert in here before we go full philosophical on the semiotics of rental agreements.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
Cantonese has 6 distinct tones, while Hokkien has 7 or 8 depending on the dialect. Linguists during the Cold War used tonal recognition tests to distinguish speakers crossing the Gobi Desert region because tonal complexity varied so sharply between language groups that it functioned as an accidental shibboleth. A speaker's tonal range could reveal not just what language they spoke, but which side of a disputed border their village was on.
Your accent could get you flagged at a Cold War checkpoint.
The Gobi Desert as linguistic border control.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Our producer is Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps other people find the show. We're back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.